including advanced weaponry that would enhance their strike capabilities and ensure the safety of Israeli soldiers. The agreement is centered on UN Resolution 1701. As part of the deal, Israel will gradually withdraw its forces from southern Lebanon over the next 60 days, while the Lebanese army and state security forces will take position in the area. On the other hand, Hezbollah is going to cease its presence along the border south of the Litani River.
The Israeli military that is on the ground in the first 2-3 kilometers from the border will remain in place for now. As the Lebanese army will redeploy back down to the south, the Israeli forces will leave. So this is not that it will take 60 days for the Israeli forces to leave the country, to leave the territory, but rather the first forces will leave over the next several days or first couple of weeks, and gradually over 60 days they will all depart.
Meanwhile, Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir expressed his firm disapproval of the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon, calling it a grave mistake and urging the need to fight until absolute victory. An agreement with Lebanon is a big mistake, a historic missed opportunity to eradicate Hezbollah. I understand all the constraints and reasons, and it is still a grave mistake, Ben-Gvir said via X. But are things, as Ben-Gvir claims, so favorable to the regime? New data, released hours before the ceasefire, reveals the catastrophic losses inflicted by Hezbollah on northern Israeli settlements. According to the Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronoth, over 9,000 buildings and 7,000 vehicles have been damaged or destroyed by Hezbollah operations against northern Israel since the war began. The report, published on November 26th, emphasizes in the conflict line settlements, there's almost no building that does not require renovation or demolition and rebuilding. The data suggests that many injuries in the north have yet to be reported, either due to evacuations of residents or because the injuries are in areas that are inaccessible under military orders. In the words of Moshe Davidovits, chairman of the Conflict Line Settlements Forum, apart from a budget framework of more than $4 billion for all the settlements in the north, there is no plan approved by the government. Not security, not economic, not social, and not any response to resilience and the communities that fell apart and the infrastructures that were destroyed. Israeli settler officials from the north of the occupied territories are outraged by the agreement, feeling abandoned by the regime. Many refuse to return to the devastated areas from which they were forced to evacuate at the onset of the fighting, believing that Hezbollah remains undeterred and viewing the agreement as an act of surrender. In the initial months following Operation Al-Aqsa flood, Hezbollah meticulously targeted border settlements, nearby bases, and military sites. As Israel ramped up its genocidal campaign, Hezbollah's operations gradually moved further north. Following the deadly attacks in Lebanon and the martyrdom of Hezbollah's Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah, Haifa and Tel Aviv fell within the reach of the Lebanese resistance's fire. The recent developments in the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hezbollah reveal a significant shift in power dynamics, showing the resilience and strategic prowess of Hezbollah in the face of Israeli aggression. Despite Israel's long-standing opposition to a ceasefire, the regime has been forced into this position due to its evident weaknesses on the battlefield. Tel Aviv's inability to achieve its objectives against Hezbollah highlights a critical failure in its military strategy. Hezbollah has demonstrated a complex and multi-layered organizational structure that allows it to absorb and recover from significant setbacks. Over time, Hezbollah has engaged in a war of attrition, systematically eroding Israel's confidence and security. Through a combination of military and psychological operations, the resistance group has instilled a profound sense of insecurity among Israelis. On the battlefield, Hezbollah has dealt numerous blows to Israeli troops, contradicting the notion that the Israeli army is invincible. Experts have long warned that Israel would be vulnerable in southern Lebanon, especially given its recent experiences in Gaza. Despite attempts to weaken Hezbollah through targeted strikes and the assassination of key figures, the Israeli regime has suffered significant casualties, revealing its strategic miscalculations. The situation has been exacerbated by Israel's controversial tactics, such as the Hannibal Directive, which resulted in the targeting of its own soldiers to prevent their capture by Hezbollah. This desperate measure underscores the extent of Israel's vulnerability and the effectiveness of Hezbollah's military operations.
Hello, my enemies. May you have a very, very, very bad day. So, it's a nice weather on the east side of the border, but your soldiers didn't enjoy it. Despite what Fihu did and come to Kfar Kila and take video and say, where is Ali Murtada? I want to tell you what is happening in Khiyam yesterday. Yesterday, there was a ground combat, very big combat in Khiyam, on the east side, and your soldiers was like a second, like a meter away from getting kidnapped. Did you know what army did? They bombed them. Your army bombed your soldier in Khiyam because they are afraid from getting kidnapped by Hezbollah. This is the way your army is treating the lives of the Israeli soldiers are fighting for you in Lebanon. And after that, Fihu will come and make videos in Kfar Kila and say, where is Ali Murtada? You are killing your own soldiers, idiot. Take care, baby.
Internationally, the Israeli regime faces increasing isolation, particularly following the issuance of arrest warrants by the International Criminal Court against its leaders. This legal acknowledgement of their actions as war crimes further diminishes Israel's standing on the global stage, even among its traditional allies.
The way that the European Union member states have approached this matter, could you care to elaborate on that, please?
It's not a matter of appointment or disappointment. It's a matter of obligations. The members, the states who signed the Rome Convention are obliged to implement the decision of the court. It's not optional. You are not a member of the court and then you decide not to implement the decision of the court. You can withdraw and say, I am no longer a member of this, but it is an obligation for member states. The candidates to become member of the European Union, among the conditions they have to fulfill, is to be member of the international court. So it would be very funny that the newcomers have an obligation that the current members don't fulfill.
The narrative that has been used to suppress dissent against Israeli actions, labeling criticism as anti-Semitism, is losing its potency in light of these developments. In summary, the Israeli regime has exhausted its strategies against Hezbollah and the broader axis of resistance, ultimately leading to its reluctant acceptance of a ceasefire. This shift not only reflects Israel's military failures, but also signals a potential turning point in the ongoing struggle for justice and resistance in the region. As the situation evolves, the prospects for a more lasting peace remain uncertain, but Hezbollah's resilience and strategic depth continue to pose a formidable challenge to Israeli occupation.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. I am Masma Jafari and she is...
I'm Zainab and you're listening to Youth Station. We are excited to be hosting this program together again and we hope all of you are doing good.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
How are you, Masuma?
Oh, I'm so good. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, I'm good. But lately, I have not been really good because I'm meeting these people who really anger me up because of their moral codes. I don't know. Like, I don't know. Do people enjoy hurting you? Do people enjoy lying? Do people enjoy just being bad or what? Do you have such people in your life?
Oh, I do, of course. Who doesn't? Well, I particularly hate people who keep saying stuff and then not standing for their words. That makes me so angry.
Okay, you said the thing that makes you very angry is that when people keep on saying and saying and saying, how do you deal with these people? Do you also keep on saying, like when they, for example, say and say towards you or about you, do you feel like defending yourself by... Saying.
So you mean by arguing?
Yeah.
No, see, of course I try to see what is the argument about. If I am wrong, I would say sorry, even if the person standing in front of me doesn't worth saying sorry to. If I had done something bad, I personally try to say sorry and just let it go. Because let's keep it simple. If I am wrong, I will say sorry. But if that person is wrong...
What will you do if that person is wrong?
I will try to make that person understand that, girl, you're doing wrong.
You'll make them understand. I'll break their teeth.
Oh, no, girl, don't go breaking people's teeth. That has bad consequences.
Okay.
Let's keep it simple.
They irritate me, you know.
But if we go on with that mindset,
okay.
There are many things that irritate you. The bus is late, it irritates you. Your boss is mad at you, that irritates you. Your professor is waiting for your deadline, that irritates you. So I think we should not get irritated easily.
Well, I really don't believe that's a girl saying me all that because I think usually men are like that. I think men are calm than girls, you know, because, yeah, let me tell you a joke before that, how I feel that and why I feel that. There was this man who went to his father and told him, I want to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And his father told him, okay, say sorry. He says, why?
No,
I just want to get married. What's wrong about it? He says, no, just say sorry. He says, oh, Dad, I don't think I did something wrong. I just came up with my, you know, opinion. I just want to get married. He says, I said, say sorry. He says, I really don't understand what's wrong with you. Why should I say sorry? And he says, I am saying, just say sorry. He says, okay, I'm sorry. He says, now you're ready to marry my son.
Oh, my God. Okay. So
when you're ready to say sorry without doing anything, you're actually... You're actually ready for marriage. And that actually happens so much in relationships. I must tell you that there's so many pointless discussions. And when men really have a big heart to avoid these discussions with their wives, and they just, you know, are okay, I'm sorry. Even if they didn't do anything. Okay. So I think...
I see what that father meant. But I think in nowadays, where women are now more educated.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be that way anymore. Especially that now women are educated from a very young age. So, yes. See, back in the days, girls would educate to a certain level. But now we can see more women in society. And of course, they're more educated now. And also, we have so many marriage counselors. Like, you just need to want to be good. And there are many ways to be better.
Yes.
So I think that mindset, oh, yes, my man should say sorry to me, even if he's not, responsible for it, should change.
Yes, indeed. I was just seeing this clip wherein this man was saying, I publicly apologize to my wife because she saw in her dream that
oh
I married
God.
To another wife.
I feel sorry for that man.
Yeah. But that was a joke, basically. But yeah, like some women are literally like that. They would make you say sorry for some things that you never did. And not only women, why should we target just women? We're sorry, women. Well, let's take a short break and have this cold sip of water before you proceed.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station.
She's Masuma and I'm Zainab, and we're talking about, shall we change our moral codes just because of others? Shall I lie basically because someone else is lying? Shall I be bad because someone else is bad? And Masuma has a lot more to say. Yeah, Masuma, I'm waiting for to get illuminated.
See, I think, no, why should I be changing my moral codes when I know this is the truth, this is the right? Why should I be changing if other people are bad? So if we want to keep changing our beliefs, we will not have an end. We will keep changing because we meet different people. We meet different people in different situations.
And it's a basic rule that, for example, lying on lying does not solve the conflict.
Yes.
Like if someone shouted at you and you shout back, it does not resolve
exactly.
the conflict. Actually, your moral codes, your values define you, isn't it?
Exactly. So my dad says this beautiful sentence to me again and again, that your respect lies beneath your words.
Indeed. Your words define you, basically.
Exactly.
Your codes define you, who you are. And you know, moreover, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that do not be a source of shame for us. Be in a way like your akhlaq should be the way, your morals, your values should be the way that adorn us.
Indeed.
Be a source of adornment for us.
Indeed. This statement is enough for me to endure all those hardships that we need to go through, just not to be a shame for Ahlul Bayt, inshallah.
Inshallah. And like, yeah, we should remember that every person is responsible for their own actions.
Yes, of course. So why should I be changing my beliefs, my moral codes, and stepping on them just because some random human being in my life or even my beloved people are bothering me? They're going to be responsible for what they're saying. Of course, Allah is just.
Indeed, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is just, and He's going to look after the matters that I am unable to. He's going to fix the things that I am unable to,
yes.
And I should hold back onto Him. And yeah, let's take a short break.
Welcome back to Youth Station. This is Masuma.
And this is Zainab. You're listening to Iran Radio. Well, we are discussing, shall I change my moral codes just because of another person? Masuma, you said every random person comes into our life and they behave in a way, or even our beloved ones sometimes behave in a way. And we should not be behaving that way with them, like we're all responsible for our actions. So far, we deduced that it's our moral codes define us. Our identity defines us, so why should I be behaving bad just because this and that particular person is bad? What else?
So I would want to say this again, that Allah is just. So imagine someone did bad to you and, well, you are so hurt. Maybe they disrespected you. And of course, being human being emotional, you might hurt them more, or you might not be able to get back your right. So I think we should, in many cases, we should leave it to God, because He's just, He will take the revenge, we can say, as it must be, not more, not less.
Well, so far we said that a bad behavior should not be always answered back with a bad behavior. But a very important question I have, Masuma, here. Should bad behavior be tolerated then?
Always. Not always, of course, not always. See, I think that we should answer back the badness when we see that if we don't stand for it, the situation will get worse. So many times when people reply bad with being bad, makes the situation worsen. So I think in that situation, we should control ourselves. But in the situation where you need to, or if the situation, the person will become worse and worse, I think you should stand.
Well, I think, you know, when I was like very, very young, the boys in my bus would bully me so much because I was a very silent child. I never knew that one day I'll be speaking much. Yeah, like I was a very silent child. So these all small boys and small girls will come around me and they would bully me just for being a silent, just not talking to them, just being very, very calm and cool. And they would bully me. And when I would come back home, I would actually complain to my father about this bullying and all. And he would give me such a beautiful advice, which I remember and I always remember it. He would say, "What do you feel like when people bully you?" I said, "I feel like slapping them, but I don't." He said, "Yes, you know, when you don't, you're actually slapping them morally."
Oh,
yeah.
Like without your words.
Without your words, you're actually slapping them even harder. So that was so beautiful. It so much entered my mind, my heart. And then it made me tolerant, really. It made me tolerant, like even many situations, like not to be reacting very fast on the situation, but not like not to be reacting overall, always be tolerant. You know, we have this Mahatma Gandhi, who's the father of India, known as the father of India. He said that if anyone slaps you, just show up your another cheek so that the person feels ashamed. And then there was this movie made on this, and like this, there was this Gandhiji, he was giving these moral codes and all. And then, but still, the man says, oh, I have calmed down. Gandhiji said that I should be giving on my another cheek. So he gives this person another cheek, and the person still beats him, you know, on another cheek as well. He reminds himself, okay, Gandhiji only said when someone beats you on one cheek, show up another cheek. He never said what to do when someone beats you on another cheek, so he then starts beating him. So that was a fun part of the movie, but that actually had a little message, like you should not be so tolerant always. Yes. Sometimes you have to show up, right?
Of course, you have to analyze the situation, because you have to think, does this person worth tolerance? What suits the situation better? If I tolerate this, what should I tolerate next? Or if I tolerate, will it make all the situation less tense? So I think we need to think about it from different aspects and then think of tolerating or not tolerating.
Yeah. There's some narrative in our traditions as well. It's that I learned akhlaq from someone. I learned values from someone who didn't have values. Like the question is asked, where did you learn the values from? And the person says, I learned values from the
a
one
person
who didn't
with
have
no value.
Who had no values. Because when you see someone doing being bad, it's not necessarily that you always be bad. Sometimes it teaches you, okay, I don't have to be like this at least, right?
Indeed. That's the time we had for today. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Everyone has a beloved, and you, dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. From wherever you're listening to us, welcome to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma once more. I have the honor to be at your service as the host. And I have two very dear guests with me, Brother Liaqat and Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum and welcome.
Thank you so much. Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for coming here. Well, I already know you, and I guess a lot of our listeners know you as well. But then, just as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself pretty much briefly. Tell us who you are and what's your background.
This is Zainab Askari, and I have studied master's in linguistics, and then I studied Hausa for past 10 years. Taking a lot of time to study Hausa, and also researching in the field of women issues.
So that's very great. And you, Brother Liaqat?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm Muhammad Liaqat Abbas from India, and right now I'm doing my master's in psychology. And of course, with Hausawi background as well, doing my Hausa studies at the same time. And of course, my specialization is in psychology, Islamic psychology, mm-hmm. and history.
That's very great. Thank you. So thank you both of you for being here. I guess like this, we can have a pretty interesting discussion today. Well, if you look back in history, in retrospect, you would see that whenever there was a change, a drastic change, there was skepticism. I'm not approving of all the skeptical thoughts that came into being, but then I'm just saying that all the drastic changes start from a point. That point is where your mind starts to question previous traditions, previous cultures, previous rules. So skepticism has become a sort of a beginning for a new change. How much do you agree with this notion?
So there are two things, I would say. Number one is the doubt in itself. Mm-hmm. And number two, the urge to ask a question. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would say doubt in itself, of course, is the starting point to ask a question. Okay. But doubt, being in doubt itself, is really not so useful, according
to
me.
For sure, yeah. We have seen it even in our life. We see that when we are in doubt, we are actually and technically crippled. We cannot move.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we don't know which route to take. Yeah. Example, okay, right now, should I take the right turn or the left turn? Or should I move ahead, like, mm-hmm. on the straight road? What is it? You see, you are stagnant. Doubt will create stagnantness, like, where a person is going to, like, just like you have said, crippled and cannot move forward, cannot
it
think properly.
It brings about logorrhea.
Exactly. The solution, of course, is asking question. When you ask question is the place where you're starting to move forward. Like now you are looking for answers. Okay. So doubt in itself, of course, it's not so useful, but asking questions, yes, it is mm-hmm. useful. That is the part of change, basically. Yeah.
So you differentiate.
Yeah,
when we say
I do.
Skepticism, you yes. come to differentiate between the question you ask and the state of being in doubt.
Exactly.
Well, Sister Zainab, what about you? I come to ask questions about my relationship with God, even. In these occasions, actually,
what happens is that I'm going to suffer so much, and it's not going to be just asking questions and whatsoever, because you know the process is going to be so prolonged.
Yes.
So in order to dig deeper in this part, in this aspect of doubt and skepticism, let's go for a short break and then we'll come back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. This is Back to Reality. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Sister Zainab and Brother Liaghat are with us to help us with the topic of doubt and skepticism, which I guess happens a lot to us nowadays. In today's world, every day is a new beginning for doubt. You are going to doubt everything and you're going to ask too much of questions. Sometimes we even are put in situations where we question every single thing we have learned from our childhood.
Well, I was critical of the fact that it's not a good thing. It's a good thing to doubt, but at the same time, I would say if it's in a balanced way. For example, if it exceeds, then it's like Imam Sadiq alayhi salam calls it pollution. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that they have not mixed up the faith with the oppression. In explanation of the same verse of Surah An'am, he says that here, when it says they have not mixed up with the oppression, it means that they have not mixed it up with the doubts. They have not mixed up it. They have not polluted it, rather.
Yeah, their faith is so pure.
Right.
And they do not impose or let any oppression of doubt to get into it.
Right, because here Imam says that doubt acts as kind of impurity on it, or an obstacle on it, or something that's going to, you know, become a hurdle in the journey of faith ahead. So yeah, like excessive doubt is not even in namaz we have, right? Like we have some ahkam, we have some of the commandments related to namaz where it says the person who doubts a lot, he should not accept his doubts.
You shouldn't go by your doubts.
Yeah, should ignore your doubts. So, yeah, not always doubts are good.
For sure. Yeah.
But a person like who accepts each and everything as well without a doubt,
that's
is also
not,
not
a good,
good
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I do believe that sometimes too much of doubt would bring about some mental issues, real mental issues, like we can see among the people who are suffering from OCD or any other branches of mental health and issues. Sometimes in these, as I just said, the postmodern concepts of doubt and skepticism is in a way that they tell you, do not judge anything. There are some rules in this modern world and postmodern conception of everything. Do not take anything as a fact forever, because everything is prone to a change. And do not judge anything, because again, you do not know everything. So when I'm put as a person, as an individual living in this hustle and bustle-ish sort of world, when I see these things, I come to accept myself as a skeptical creature. Whatever I see, I'm not going to believe anything, and I'm not going to make any judgment. So the world is actually pushing me toward this sort of thinking.
Yes.
How can I deal with this?
Of course, like just like the social media, I would say it is. And mainly when we speak about the world, it's actually the social media. It's about the internet. It's about everything online, yeah? And right now, the AI which we have, mashallah, isn't it? It makes us create more doubt, and it will make us
and
a doubtful
And the situation
person.
Would get worse by time.
Definitely. So I would say, like, you know, of course, just like the sister has stated about a hadith as well, we shouldn't be making our minds polluted because of doubt. Actually, doubt has two categories. And number one is the doubt of a normal human being, okay? A doubt of a doubtful person, example. Number one, where we see a doubt of a normal human being, example, we see a child asking a question in the class. Excuse me, ma'am, I have a doubt. I have a question, okay? The doubt is equal to a question over here, okay?
Yeah,
which is a
for
good
a normal
thing.
Person.
For normal people, okay? A doubt of a very doubtful person, example, like who doubts in everything, okay? It's not just pertain to namaz, okay? For few people, okay, it's pertain only to namaz or roza or fast.
The
or
worship.
Example,
the worship.
Yeah, example, the worshipping acts or about the beliefs. Yeah. Few people have doubts only with regards to beliefs. Few people have doubts only with regards to ahkam or the Islamic laws.
Example. Some with the practical life.
Exactly. But few people have it in all the fields, like yeah. be it with beliefs, be it with mm-hmm. everywhere.
And they've been concurred by doubts.
Exactly. Over here, the first solution, what comes over here is, example, just like you have said, OCPD, example, the personality disorder in psychology, where the person is going to doubt on everyone, okay, and,
yeah.
and there's a lot to say. But to just cut short, the solution is, of course, the person should have to go to a consultant, a proper consultant.
A therapist,
a psychologist,
for sure.
A therapist, exactly. Yeah. Where this, for this kind of person who has doubts in all the fields, in all the arenas, like, yeah. okay, I'm having doubt even in beliefs, I'm having doubt even in personal life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because of this, the person is completely in distress. It's going to yeah. dysfunction.
And devastated, because sometimes the situation is going to go to an extreme that really is so dangerous.
Exactly. But as of a common person, example, me as a common person, example, you and Sister Zainab, we have a doubt. Okay, it's always good. It's always good to ask question. Doubt, I mean, in the form of a question. Yeah,
yeah, in the form
we
of a question.
We are after solving the question. But doubt in itself, example, you speak to your teen, example, and you say, oh, you know what, I'm having a question, and you ask the question and you put a doubt in the teen's head
yeah.
and you don't answer it. This is a very bad thing.
You're inflicting misery, actually, without
exactly.
bringing any answer to it, without offering any answer and providing any answer to it. I even have thought about that. This is very also, you know, thought-provoking. Sometimes a professor comes to a class and then he starts to ask a question.
Yeah.
Your friend talks to you, they ask a question, they start to pollute your peaceful thoughts, maybe peaceful, but generally speaking, they come to open up a question and living it open-ended. This would be actually the start of a very dangerous game, I guess. In some occasions, when you are saying things, when you are asking questions, when you are bringing up about new stuff, you have to provide a set of answers for it as well.
Yeah.
You shouldn't let anything just go the wild way as it goes. I mean, about concerning the skeptical issues.
Yeah. Because when we let it go that way, it will be polluted more and more with the doubt and... Mm-hmm. Like in terms of learning, as you said, learning process, Imam Ali Al-Islam says, whenever I was learning truth, I never intermingled it with doubts in the path of
Hut. So it's very important
yeah.
as a teacher, as a classmate, I don't know, as a co-worker, you shouldn't actually be in that position to hurt people's peace of mind with the pollution that will get into their mind and then make them suffer too much. If doubt means asking a question and
yeah.
questioning the old notions, it's good.
But one of the solutions that I happen to see here is to, especially in today's, living in today's world, is like, as brother also mentioned, it's mostly coming in from media. I would say I have to educate myself with media literacy.
Yeah.
I should have it. The more I have the media literacy, the more it will help me
mm-hmm.
to take in content with less doubt or taking content where I have to doubt and where I know I don't have to doubt. And especially when I analyze things, what is in line with my beliefs, what is not in line with my beliefs.
Yeah. Well, so we got to this point that doubt, if it equals asking questions, that would be so good because it's going to flourish more out of our mind. Maybe we're going to open some new windows in front of ourselves. It would broaden our horizon and it would enrich our perspective. But then if you want to conclude the entire session for the skeptical people, how would it be?
for those skeptical people, they, just like I have said, they have to go first to towards a proper consultant or a therapist, example. And as for those people who are the common people, I would encourage them like to ask questions.
Yeah. Yeah,
with regards to everything.
Maybe more, reading more books.
Example.
Maybe having some interaction with some intellectuals who would give some answer to their
having
questions.
Having healthy discussions, example, yeah. would help. But I would tell, remember for 10 times, go and enter those areas where you're going to get answers. It's not just creating doubts.
Open so, new doubts for you.
Yeah, exactly. Like you have confirmation about something through proper knowledge, through healthy knowledge about beliefs, example, about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, about wilaya, the concept of leadership, example, the concept of even in political stance as well. But now that you are going into a wrong phase or you're going into the company of wrong people, they might create wrong doubts in your mind. Example,
exactly.
I'm talking about the common people.
Yeah.
For those doubtful people,
they
have to come.
They would agitate the situation even more.
Yeah, for those doubtful, very doubtful people, they have to come to. They have to become normal people, okay? Like OCD, OCPD people. They have to become normal people. As for the normal people, go with good companionships, good
intellectuals.
People. Exactly. Intellectuals have proper discussions, group discussions with proper answers. And do not go or enter those kind of groups where they create doubt and they spoil you,
exactly.
basically. Yeah.
I always actually recommend it to even myself that whenever you have a problem, do not come and share it with commoners just like you, because sometimes they might say something that it would actually fan the flame even more. You have to go to someone who already has been there and done that, has gone through too much of studies and have been an expert in that field. Just like what you said, in faith, if you have doubts, you have to really meet a specialist in the religious studies. Well, this was all, and thank you. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أما رايزك لتصي دليلتك وانسك
From Beirut.
Hello and welcome to today's episode, broadcasting from the heart of Beirut, and I'm your host, Farah Atwi. The World Bank reports that approximately 90,000 homes in Lebanon have been partially or completely destroyed. The infrastructure has suffered significant damage. The Israeli army continues to impose restrictions on those attempting to return south of the Litani River. But despite all these challenges, we are still seeing waves of Lebanese citizens returning to their villages, even though they know that they won't find their homes. In contrast, the Israeli settlers remain fearful of returning to their settlements in the north, despite their government's assurances that it is safe to do so. On another note, Israel is still violating Lebanese sovereignty despite the ceasefire agreement. France, however, has warned that this ceasefire could be at risk after registering approximately 52 Israeli violations since the agreement was established. The situation unfolds against the backdrop of recent events in Syria, where the Syrian army is intensifying operations against terrorist groups in Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama provinces to counter recent attacks. To discuss the Israeli violations, the threats to broker a ceasefire, and the rising tension in Syria amid military escalation against armed groups, we have here Mr. Laith Malouf, a journalist, joining us. Hello and welcome, Mr. Laith.
Thank you for having me.
At the beginning, we need to discuss. I would like to have your own point of view of how do you see the ceasefire agreement. Do you think it's a fragile one? Or it ended the war completely?
I think it's temporary. we most probably will see a return to hostilities either by the end of the 60-day term, which will be when President Trump assumes office, and or even before that, given what is happening in Syria that you just referred to.
In previous interviews, you were kind of pessimistic about a ceasefire agreement, and you said that you don't see it coming any time soon. However, now with the ceasefire, you still see it as fragile. You still see it as it will not have a long term.
Because, number one, we see the genocide continuing in Gaza, and we see at the same time from Netanyahu's speech accepting the quote-unquote ceasefire, he said he's going to target Syria and then Iran, and we see already that in action. So given that the battle is still ongoing across the whole region, it's very probable, given that also Iran still needs to retaliate for the attack that happened to it last time, that we will see a return to this war in Lebanon also.
Okay. We are still witnessing a long stream of displaced individuals returning without hesitation to their destroyed villages and town, whether in the south, Bekaa or Dahiye, totally ignoring Israeli warnings, and even though they know that they may not find their home intact. On the other hand, despite the Israeli state's assurances for the people of the north or the settlers in the north that it is safe to go to your own settlements, it's safe to enter the north, with all that being said, what we see and what we witness is just anger from the people or from the settlers in the north, that they don't feel safe to go back, they don't trust the Israeli government. There were promises that have been made, and up till now, we haven't seen them, according to them. How do you view this contradiction and from both sides?
Well, number one, the Lebanese people are going back to their land. The Zionist colonists are going back to stolen land that they thought that they can get for free and that they can continue to live on that land that they stole. And as we see now with the war, they know that there's a price for the theft of Palestinian land and the colonization. So, you know, the Israeli regime is even offering $35,000 for any colonist that goes back to the north.
Yes.
And there's very little of them that
excited
want to do
to go.
Yes. So it's because, obviously, look, colonialism, the social contract in colonialism between the settlers and the regime, any place, is they that they can steal and colonize land and kill indigenous people at no cost, and even celebrate those murders and so on, and enjoy them. And as we saw for the last year, this has become, you know, this social contract of colonialism between the settlers and the regime is collapsing. The regime cannot anymore offer free land and with no consequences for the theft by the colonizers.
Okay, I'm going back to the fact that you don't believe that this ceasefire will stay for a long time. But don't you think that if of course, Benjamin Netanyahu highlighted in the interview that this is not, we did not stop the war, it's just a ceasefire, and if we feel any threat or any violation, then of course you will go back and ignite the war again. Do you think that he was pleasing the people of the north that you were just speaking about right now?
Well, he
was. Because at one point he did not keep his promises to them.
Yeah, I mean, he was also really threatening the Lebanese resistance and the Lebanese people in general. And as we saw, the ceasefire, quote unquote, didn't really stop the Israelis
fully
from attacking Lebanese villages in the south and violating Lebanese sovereignty. And even today, you know, two nights ago, we had drones flying over Beirut again.
Yes.
So the ceasefire seems like to be a one-way.
Even
the
in
Lebanese
2006 war, after the ceasefire was implemented, also we saw a gradual, not a complete halt of these actions. We also saw similar scenarios, Mr. Relay. Do you think this is who the Israeli is, and this is how he is? He cannot evacuate immediately, he needs time. And that's why probably Sheikh Naim Qassem, in his own speech, did not give a lot of attention to these violations, and rather went to actually politically support the Lebanese army in deploying or in putting the hands of Hezbollah with the Lebanese army in order to, like, prevail power and prevail peace in the region. But don't you think this is a normal procedure or part of the ceasefire agreement?
I think the resistance, with the speech of Naeem Qasem, Sayyid Naeem Qasem, is still giving a chance to the Lebanese military and the Lebanese state to deliver on their duties.
Yes.
I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, we have history of decades of the Lebanese government working against the resistance and decades of the Lebanese military failing on their duties to protect the land of Lebanon. So to expect them to suddenly change and work with the resistance and to for the safety of Lebanon under the conditions that we saw after a outright eradication campaign of the Lebanese people and destruction of the Lebanese infrastructure, I think that's people are going to find themselves disappointed very fast. The Lebanese government didn't change. We don't see a new prime minister that is pro-resistance in power, or a new president that's pro-resistance, or a new head of the Lebanese army that is not beholden by the American embassy. I almost said the Israeli embassy.
Yes.
So, history is there to learn from it, not to ignore it and pretend that things can happen out of the blue.
Yes. Okay, so do you think that Hezbollah is deliberately standing back?
I think Hezbollah needed...
They can actually send messages to the politicians inside Lebanon and these voices that have been always criticizing and asking for dismantling Hezbollah?
Well, number one, Hezbollah needed a break to reorganize itself, especially that there is new people in all the important positions in the hierarchy of Hezbollah that need to acquaint themselves with each other, and the cadre of Hezbollah to acquaint themselves with the decision processes of Hezbollah. Also, Hezbollah needed to rearm itself because, you know, whether we like it or not, there was a lot of hits that the Hezb had received during this war. And finally, it's also because if Hezbollah didn't accept the ceasefire, the rest of the political class in Lebanon that is collaborating with the Americans and West would have lined up saying that Hezbollah is the one that's causing the destruction of the country. So now, at least, with this ceasefire and the continued violations of this ceasefire by the Zionists, it is exposing, actually, anyone who is...
Want to defend the land, they may be allowed to do so because Hezbollah actually gave them the chance for that.
Yes, and so if we return to hostilities within the next 60 days, Hezbollah would have a better support within the population of Lebanon who would understand why we're back in this war.
France actually, France criticized this, and they also said that there are more than 52 violations by the Israelis, and that will actually cause the it will make the ceasefire more fragile even. How do you comment on France's opposition towards this?
Good propaganda, that's what I would say, because France is the colonial power that chopped off Lebanon from Syria. It is also what we see is the French refusing to arrest Netanyahu and Gallant if they enter their territory under the ICC arrest warrant. And we also see how the French intelligence were directly involved in instigating the Wahhabi death squads that are attacking right now Syria. Or 2 months ago, the French intelligence met with these Wahhabi death squads in Aleppo. And,
but don't you think they're presenting themselves as the mediators of this ceasefire agreement? And that's why they have the right to actually comment or criticize on these violations.
They can present themselves whatever way they want to. If we're stupid, we can take things as the cover of the book tells us it is. But if we're smart and we know 100 years of relations between France and Lebanon and the whole region shows that they are a colonial power and that they are supporting of Zionism, there wouldn't be Israel today if there was no French occupation and British occupation of our land here. France is directly responsible for the genocide that is happening.
So you're saying that there is a deal that happened under the table between the Israelis and France for this ceasefire agreement to see the light?
I'm saying that France
because
right
also
now...
France, if you want to observe the situation or their stances towards the Israelis, once the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant, they were supportive of the ICC. However, Then we've seen like different talks coming from France that they will not abide by some of the rules or some of the terms or some of the conditions that were kept or placed by the ICC towards Israel. So it's like the information or the stance is going back and forth, and nothing is stable towards how they want to see Israel or how they want to deal with Israel.
So, you know, we go back to the words of martyr Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, don't take things from what you read or see. Take look at what's happening on the battleground. On the battleground, it's clear. France is a vassal of the United States. France doesn't have even a democracy right now. We have a dictator, quote-unquote, President Macron, that is refusing the majority left party that controls the parliament their right to govern, and has appointed Zionists by decree into a prime minister, and is oppressing his own people all for the Zionist colony.
Yes, but so, throughout the time when Israel was actually violating Lebanon's sovereignty, especially after the ceasefire was implemented, and politicians and commentators, they were actually criticizing, where is the United States? Where are the mediators? Where are the people that were involved in this implementation of the ceasefire? Why anyone is not recording these violations and talking about them? This is how the scenario was, until France came in and spoke what was said, what it said. And at least someone spoke about it, or someone mentioned it. Do you see it as a positive sign?
I see the only positive sign is the people in the streets of France, the population in Europe and the West, getting fed up with their own politicians that are two-faced.
Okay.
But there will be no change in French position of support of Zionism and
colonialism. Despite the fact that European Union and France, they're calling for giving technical support to the Lebanese army, capacity building, enforcing the Lebanese army, send all the support that they need, especially that they need more than 15,000 Israeli troops at the border, Lebanese army at the borders, but until now they have 7. So France and the European Union are putting so much effort in that. Why?
Why? Because they the Lebanese army is not actually armed enough to threaten the Israeli military.
Or do you think because they want them to retaliate on Hezbollah and on the resistance?
Well, that's another thing. You know, it's been decades now that the Western powers have been trying to build up the Lebanese military just enough to fight Hezbollah,
yes,
but not enough to protect the country. And so as long as there's no air defenses, as long as there's no air force in the Lebanese army, the only job that it can do is oppress the Lebanese population and the Lebanese resistance. And that's what the Western powers are interested in.
Okay. Do you think that the war ignited in Syria a couple of days ago is related to the event happening in Gaza and in Lebanon, especially that according to observers, once Benjamin Netanyahu threatened Bashar al-Assad in his latest speech, one of the latest speeches, then definitely a lot of people actually connected these two together. After 3 days from that, war ignited inside Syria.
Yes, it's definitely related. It's directly related. It's part of the plan of creating a new Middle East.
But are they that powerful? I mean, the capacity and the speed of entering Aleppo and taking over a lot of huge areas.
It's, yes, of course. You know, remember last time it was Hezbollah that saved the Syrian state,
yes,
and the battle in Idlib and Aleppo was led by the Syrian army with the support of Hezbollah. And right now, Hezbollah is out of Syria. It has suffered huge blows. It cannot come to the defense of Syria, and this is why the original plan that the Americans and their Zionist vessels had was to take out Syria in early 2010s, and then, you know, isolate Hezbollah and then attack Iran. And they failed in Syria, so we saw them come to Hezbollah again over the last year, and now they're going back to attack Syria.
Because of the failure in Lebanon and their failure in Gaza, now they went back, according to your own plan, they went back to the Syrian territory?
Yes, but they also, the Zionists and the West, believe that Hezbollah right now is weak enough that it can, you know,
cannot support
the Syrian government, and therefore the Syrian government is left alone. But We see right now 35,000 Iraqi fighters coming into Syria to defend Aleppo. We see also the engagement of the Russian Air Force at a rate that we haven't seen in almost a decade in Syria.
These terrorist groups came as if way stronger because, according to reports, they have been trained for 6 months now. It's not just a sudden invasion. They have been trained for six now. They found sophisticated weapons with them and tools or ammunitions that are used for the first time, as if there is a huge plan ready for them and was on. They were only waiting for the button or the right timing to commit these atrocities inside Syria. So do you think it's all planned? And yes, it is the right timing, in your opinion, according to them?
Of course, it's all planned. These are militias that are controlled by somebody else. These are...